And now, here are your hosts of Lab Radio, sponsored by Coinstructive.
Hey, this is Aaron Mungle. I'm here with Coinstructive. I'm here with Chris Groshong.
Hey, guys.
And we have Paul Snow, the fabulous Paul Snow from Factum, your CEO and founder, right?
Yes. I'm the chief architect of the for-profit companies, yes.
Got it. I like the very specific answer. Thank you for joining us, first of all. Mm-hmm. Great talk. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you've gotten to this point.
Well, my background, I am a older developer in this space. I date
Yoda.
Back to 82. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
May the force be with you.
I'm not going to do my Yoda imitation. So I go back. I've been in compilers and interpreters and rules engines for a long time. Also done children's software and embedded systems and ground penetrating radar, a bunch of stuff in the past. A lot of assembly language, operating system design, PostScript interpreters, all that kind of stuff in my past.
Were you trained in sort of a traditional engineering or computer science?
I was for what was done in the very late 70s and early 80s. Back in those days, we were still on cards for my undergrad, so I was, you know, typing out cards in the middle of the night, submitting card decks to a computer center that would run them, and then the printout of your job would get put into a particular shelf some hours later, and you would look at it, and you would debug it, and you would reiterate it, maybe rerun it. And then you'd go away and come back again and see. And so because of that nature of programming in those days, my favorite trick was just to go to bed at 3 in the afternoon and wake up around 1 o'clock and go down to the computer center, because it was 24 hours, go down to the computer center in the dead of night when no one's there, particularly weekends, because weekends, even computer scientists, believe it or not, like to play. But so it's like prime, you know, dead time when you have an entire mainframe to yourself and you can run your job and get the printout immediately. And that it's so amazing to be able to program in a way where when you submitted your program, you could actually get results back, you know, within minutes. That was just great.
Wow.
Great turnaround time. Anyway, so you can imagine every now and then when I'm sitting there typing away at Go, and you know, basically it's Go execute sort of thing. I think back to the days when large significant programs were measured in pounds of cards that you stuffed through a reader.
Wow.
And then you waited hours for the results. So yeah, I've done a lot of things and I've come a long ways. I got into Bitcoin because of articles that I read that fascinated me about the idea that there could be a digital currency that wasn't issued by some country or bank or something. I did not read the white paper. Probably the multi-million dollar mistake that I made in 2011 was not reading the white paper and understanding what Bitcoin was. And so instead, I kind of took the word of journalists who were trying to explain it, which, by the way, that's a mistake. People, if you hear about a technology and the article you're reading is something that was in Wired or someplace like that, might be a wonderful article. I'm not disparaging anybody, but if you're curious about a technology, go to the source. Go read the actual
paper itself.
Papers.
The comments can be useful though, because like they will rip a writer apart that has a bad view of, or like a not accurate view. They will just, so comments can be a good direction.
I have absolutely no, yeah, absolutely.
But you're right. You know, sort of the more crowdfunded. What is this general thought from it, the blob, right?
There's a word for it. It starts with an R. Something like research.
Oh my God! What
research.
A concept.
Yeah, research.
Like that's in books and stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you actually look up this stuff. And here's the other fascinating thing about technology: you can actually talk to the people that do it. Now, you wouldn't think so. I mean, even myself, for a lot of years, I figured if the big name in Technology X was doing all that important stuff in Technology X, there's absolutely no way I could talk to them. You know, because I was just lonely, you know, lowly little guy, you know, in Louisiana. No, they would never talk to me, right? But in fact, the reality is that all these people that are doing these things that you see their names on this technology, they're actually just people. And a lot of them will respond to an email. A lot of them will take a phone call and talk to you. You can actually talk to people. And so
what a thought. They're accessible.
Yeah, they are. They're more accessible than you think. And then, of course, today's technology is really cool. I mean, you guys are doing this great podcast. I really appreciate it. I was just walking around.
No, we started talking about the mic. That was like a very true tech moment where we were just like fascinated by the like tech,
which
I am too. And I try to learn as much as I can about, you know, I like the whole understanding. So yeah, we had a total like the enjoying the craft moment, you know,
right?
The tech. Yeah.
But the fact is, you and I can sit down in a spontaneous moment, mm-hmm. have a nice conversation,
yep.
and that can go out to literally
the world.
Yeah, 10, 15 people. Hundreds, thousands, who knows how, you know, and it can be there for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And so it's an incredible technology.
And there's really cool things happening with like smart cars, like, you know, like children growing up with YouTube, they don't distinguish between YouTube and TV. They're like, you know, the guy on the internet, you know, like to them, you know, they don't. So that's interesting. So back
interesting.
To your point, like when you start integrating this with smart cars, like can you imagine pulling, maybe podcasts will be as viable as like a radio station or a YouTube or a TV station. So to your point, you know, there's going to be a time where we can hit our button and
you know. I do pull down lots of podcasts
nice.
And I do listen to them when I'm walking or running.
Mm-hmm.
And or in the car or on the plane and that sort of
Where
thing.
Where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up south of Shreveport in Louisiana.
Nice.
So it is only about 5 miles from the Texas border. So
nice.
not a lot of Louisiana would have claimed we were East Texas, really. Culturally and whatnot, probably they're right. But having been raised in Louisiana, we do understand and acknowledge the Mecca quality of New Orleans, and I do make my yearly pilgrimage.
Trek. Yeah, there you go.
Pilgrimage to New Orleans, where I worship at the Cafe du Monde and Court of the.
I'm gonna have to go.
Yeah,
I had some
sisters.
Friends that went and got what do you call that? That band that follows you around.
Yeah,
the
Zydeco bands.
Well, there's like a name for it. Like it's It's just like a band you can hire to like follow you around when you go down the street.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they got I can't think of the name. Hannibal Buress had made a joke, like he had a whole comedy routine about it. So my friends were like, "Hey, let's actually do that."
Oh wow, well that would be a whole lot of fun.
You basically go down to the city and you file permit for a parade, right?
Yeah, and they'll like, or it's yeah, some yeah, there
or
might
something
be
something like that, and like you basically
they'll just follow you around.
You just file a permit, and then a band follows you wherever you go in town.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was like, I want that.
Yeah, exactly. We need like a factum,
have a
like,
band following,
band
you
following around, like that factum team building, like meeting you with Nola. See
yeah.
You there.
And if you will pay for a ghost tour in New Orleans, that is like one of the funnest things ever.
Oh,
you'll
cool.
show up at twilight at some part in the French Quarter, and they'll walk around and point out all of the scary, horrible, terrible things that have happened in New Orleans.
Wow.
You know, everything from plagues that killed 80% of the population to, you know, Civil War hospitals and all the ghost stories that people are even recounting today of spirits that they see. And it's just it's a hoot. So I highly, highly, highly recommend the ghost tour in French Quarter.
I'm glad you put that on my radar. It's a place you hear about, but you just, yeah, no, I hadn't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, anyway, cool. So that
that was awesome.
It's
awesome
so totally typical Bitcoin.
No, I'm glad. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, but it's cool to hear, like, you know, where like your background and just like
yeah.
was funny. Where were we? No, factum. It's like you started a company or something. Like that's why you're here, right?
Yeah. Well, I was here talking about factum. I've actually been in the Bitcoin space for a while. I I did a little experiment with passing Bitcoin around the world a couple of times where I took a little bit of Bitcoin and found some Redditors around the world and we passed it around. And the first time one person would send it to the other person, the next person would send it to the other. And as soon as you get a confirmation, most wallets will let you send it to the next person. So that's what we did. We wait for one confirmation, send the Bitcoin, We did 11 transactions, 10 of them were international for a distance of 3 times around the world in an hour and 41 minutes. And at the end of the hour and 41 minutes, the entire half of Bitcoin at the time was deposited with the one foundation established by Jet Li in response to natural disasters.
Wow.
And they were taking Bitcoin as donations in 2013. And there was an earthquake in China that they were responding to, and so we were able to. That Bitcoin was spendable in less than 2 hours. After having traveled a distance 3 times around the world, 10 international transactions, 2 U.S. domestic transactions. You do that with a dollar, and how many dollars would be left at the end of that? You know.
Negative.
Starting
you mean
at one.
Like through traditional channels, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like yeah. Everyone would just, until it would be gone, basically, yeah. From all these, yeah.
And then we did it again with about the same result a few months later. And I intend to do a passing Bitcoin around the world yet again. And at this point, I probably can get a full 24 hours worth of people to be involved.
Awesome.
And you know, maybe
this is like a digital Jules Verne. You're like,
yeah, it would be so much fun.
Around the world in an hour and 40 minutes.
An hour.
Around the world in 80 minutes.
But, yeah, there you go.
But, of course, now we also have other technologies that clear a lot faster. You have things like Next and BitShares, mm-hmm. and Ethereum. And obviously, we still have Bitcoin. No, Bitcoin's dead, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, for the 89th time.
Yeah. Let's all bow our heads to the dead
and
Bitcoin.
Neck is getting tired.
Yeah.
The bowing.
Yeah, you know, you bow, you stand up, you bow, you stand up. I mean, I know one of these days it will be dead.
It's like Catholicism.
Anyway, so then after that, I also got involved with a meetup group in Austin and ran a meetup group for a long time. And part of that meetup group was a mini Austin Bitcoin conference series. I did that, did 3 of those. That's where I met Jason King and a lot of other people in this Bitcoin space. Had them either physically or Skype into those little conferences. And then that led to the Texas Bitcoin Conference, which I ran a couple of times. And we'll probably do another one later on this year. We're
Texas.
I've been really busy with Factum, so I didn't do it in the spring like I've done it the past 2 years, but I still intend to do something this year. More to come about that.
Nice.
When the plans gel.
When the time is right.
When the time is right. And then I also got involved with Factum. And Factum is a effort to create a general purpose data layer for the Bitcoin blockchain. The observation is that that a lot of people are making is that the blockchain has applications that go beyond currency. In fact, probably most applications of immutable ledger technology, distributed immutable ledger technology, otherwise called the blockchain, are not necessarily financial transactions, not literally the trading of signed transactions of one coin to an mm-hmm. from one person to another. Mm-hmm. So they are instead creating audit trails for businesses. So if you're in a contractor-subcontractor relationship and you would like the subcontractor to be able to demonstrate and prove that they are performing in real time the way you expect them to, you would really, really like to have a immutable ledger that's time-stamping their entries so that you know, A, they're doing what they're supposed to do, and B, they're documenting it as they're doing it as you would like them to. Now, are you really going to make them open up a laptop and type some entry every time they do something? No. You're going to build this kind of stuff inside of applications. What kind of applications? Well, accounting applications, for instance. If they're making payments, they obviously should be using accounting software to document and generate those payments. It would be trivial for that software to write an entry in a chain somewhere that you can review later. I mean, we're still in this concept of a subcontractor doing work for you, right? Another thing would be managing records, say health records. If you've got someone who's responsible for your health records, you would probably like them to document when they're disclosing those records to another party. You know, that'd be kind of cool. And furthermore, be able to document what they disclose. And we would like, any time a test has been run on us or we've been given a medication or a prescription, we'd like to have that record placed in some chain so that later when we ourselves can't even remember what tests have been run on us and what studies there are, that there was some place that I can go to and figure out where those records are. And even if they're not in my own possession, I should be able to find the party involved. And all this stuff can be encrypted. There's all kinds of neat technologies you can lay over on this. The obvious solution for some of this stuff is a smartphone app that provides you the security and privacy of cryptography to protect your health information and yet lets you manage it and lets you track it and lets you leverage it. Because I'll even give you a case in point. I know I had an MRI done somewhere in the mid-2000s, and some doctor did a study on me and sees some collection of blood cells in my liver, okay? Says it's totally normal, probably has been there for a long time. Have you ever had a study done, you know, maybe 10 years ago? I said, yeah, I did. And they go, well, I'd like to see that, and I can verify it. That was like months ago. I still haven't tracked down where that study is. It's pretty important in the sense that if it proves that this anomaly has always been there, then it's nothing to worry about. And if it wasn't there and it appeared, then it's something that I should be more concerned about. Not necessarily concerned, because again, it's still not necessarily important. But that's the indicator. But that's it, though. I had work done for me that I paid money for, and don't let anybody fool you. Just because you pay for insurance that pays for your health care does not mean you don't pay for your health care.
Right.
Because you actually, Americans pay 30% more money to insurance companies than is paid to health care providers to provide services. So they make money.
Of course.
Come on.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
They're
yeah.
insurance companies.
Yeah.
So there is a markup. You are paying for your own health insurance. No, you're paying for your health care. Right. Anyway. And the blockchain can help us find information, secure information, and keep information more private by requiring documentation of disclosures and that sort of thing. Stuff that it just is impossible today. You can't walk up to your doctor and ask them, who have you disclosed this information to? Hang on now. But the blockchain has the promise of making these things more trackable.
And here's kind of what I'm, just to kind of summarize like the main idea, which is, you mentioned, yep, there's the money, cool. Everyone have fun with that. You're saying data and
data,
the metrics
yes.
behind data. And you know what? I also do a show on the cloud and I've heard very similar insights. Like, I would have thought that they had a ton of insight into software. No, not at all. They were seeing if their website was working by if the server was on. I mean, that was the level of like how you monitor like a website or software. And now there's actual specific analytics showing you specific things that are going wrong. So what I'm hearing is we're getting more granular, and probably there's a much bigger opportunity. Like, I'm thinking of the glacier picture, like the data part is that underwater stuff that you are like, what is that? I don't know. But the, kind of what you said,
yes.
there's all these applications of this data model.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say it's metrics kind of like or sort of new insights that are generated from
Yes,
this
well,
way of doing things?
Really, it's very pervasive in many, many, many ways. absolutely, we would be able, in a blockchain world with the right architectures, we would be able to have more metrics about the information that exists about us, particularly in the context of healthcare, but also legally, things like, you know, how many licenses and permits have you had through the years to do, you know, whatever? Where are they? What state are they in? And who would you need to contact if you needed to update any of that stuff? Most of us, what happens is we just kind of forget about that stuff until you go, oh, you know, I guess I need to go get that car registration updated, or I need to go get that inspection. Let me look at the sticker and see what the sticker says.
You know, I'm also thinking like passports and visas. That's passports. Kind of a nightmare, you know? Can you imagine if you didn't have to worry if you lost your passport, you're still connected, right?
Right.
I mean, that could save so much headache, you know?
Well, think of it in terms of a country that isn't the U.S. Mm. Right now, most countries in the world are not prepared to understand truly whether a passport is really legitimate or not.
Okay. So there's a lot of fraud that goes under the radar.
The CIA or some other organization can create an identity, produce papers, hand it to the person, and they can go into a foreign country. And it's one thing for the U.S., okay? The U.S. generates an ID that they decide to act like it's legit. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's their business. It's their country. Any other country, though, might like to have some security that a identification from the U.S. is not something that was just made up in the last month or two. Well, the blockchain allows you to actually put a stake in the ground when these documents are generated so that they can age over time. And someone who walks up and every piece of identification they give you is only a month old, probably not real.
Right.
Probably a little suspicious. And even if it's all legit, you now know who you need to look at, okay? But if the identification and all these documents is 4, 5, 10 years old, then it's very, very, very hard to know that you want to generate a fake identity with all of the life entries that go along with that 10 years ago so that you can present something today and try to get through some checkpoint. And so adding the element of time into security vastly enhances security. And that's one of the things the blockchain does for you. Let's think about it, your computer. You have administrative rights, but someone who can hack your computer and create a new login and assign it admin rights can now have access to your entire system. Mm-hmm. Perfectly legitimate, because it's the way an OS is built. But you might want to say, you know, after you've had a computer running for a month or two, say, you know, I'm not going to trust an identity that isn't at least a month or two old. Or I've had this computer running for a year. I'm not going to trust an identity. You know, give yourself enough time that if someone creates a fake user ID, there's time to recognize that that has happened, recognize someone's trying to hack into your system, and remove them
and
before they
can
see.
Can the log files be timestamped? So like when someone makes a change, that would be under the same framework you're discussing.
Yeah, you would hash all the log files, so you can't even edit the log file and change it without detection. So that's the whole idea with security is being able to recognize when you're in a suspicious situation.
Okay.
So there's all kinds of really neat things you can do with security once you have a bona fide way that's completely independent of the computer system that you're involved with, bona fide way of seeing time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even imagine. There's probably dozens of better ideas than what I've thrown out.
So would you say, Factum, you say data layer, so like, you know, is that connected with containers at all, or is that kind of a totally separate...
Containers?
Well, like with like Docker and
like
stuff
Docker.
Like that.
Yeah.
I guess I have still quite a lot to learn in terms of the technical details, but I was just wondering, like, how do you care? Like, you say data layer, but I'm just wondering, how does that play out in terms of the...
Well, the easiest... Let me explain a little bit about Docker, because we are using that technology.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting to understand the cloud and understand servers and understand things, technologies like Docker, because when people, you know, historically, I want to put up a website, I set up a server room, I put boxes in the room, wire them up, hook them to the internet, boot up software, and I'm on, and I have a website. Okay, that, historically, that's what you did. And if you were a hobbyist, that's what you did. But that's not what you do anymore. Mm-hmm. Now what you do is you go get an account with Azure, which is like the best web technology ever. Oh, did I say they did a deal with Factum and brought us on the Azure platform.
Because they have a blockchain backend that they were built.
They're taking all of the major, they've gone to all of the major blockchain technology companies, Factum included, and provided them with very, very generous credits to build whatever virtual machines, whatever servers you need, so that you can provide access to those technologies to other applications that are running on Azure. So, and this will get into Docker here in just half a second. So anyway, you go to Azure, you go to Amazon Cloud or Google Cloud or, you know, some of these other guys, and you can configure a server. Now, you're configuring it in software. Used to, you had a box that you went and got from Fry's that had a certain set of specs. Mm-hmm. Now you go to a web page and you set in your specs, and they give you maybe a physical machine or maybe a virtual machine that fits those specs. Okay, and that's a virtual machine. And then I, just like it was a real computer, I can install operating systems on it, and I can install applications, and I can configure it and give it IP addresses and all that kind of stuff, and run a web server, and it runs just like I had a box in my room, except that it's being managed by Microsoft or Google or Amazon, right, or whoever, right? Now, so what is Docker? Well, Docker is like a little virtual machine that you can slide into your computer at home or into one of these virtual machines on the cloud. So it's like a machine inside of a machine. And so
it's like a holodeck or something.
Yeah, it's like a holodeck. Sure. And so I can create a Docker instance. I can install Factum in it and get all the settings and configurations just right, so it's all just working. And then when I run that Docker image, Factum runs. I can run Factum on my computer. I could run Factum on one of my virtual machines. And then someone else who's building a server on Azure can practically just push a button, mm-hmm, and get that Docker image of Factum installed in their machine and running. And they don't have to configure it or anything. They didn't have to know. They didn't have to read our how-to. They didn't have to go through the 48 things that you have to do to set up something. They just pressed a button and it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is why Azure gave us this very, very, very generous budget to put stuff into their platform so that we could provide that value add to other people using Azure.
So basically the cloud has enabled you to build this pretty robust and smooth, streamlined framework, right?
Yes.
Without it being really bottlenecked, right?
Well, the framework is the framework, but the idea is the installation and deploying of the framework is very smooth.
Got it. Labor intensive.
Yeah, yeah.
Taking
away a lot of the DevOps stuff. DevOps, a developer who's very attuned to all the issues with operations of servers and clouds and server configurations and all that, network configurations. So Docker is simplifying those processes.
Right. And yeah, my understanding was containers. I actually interviewed on the cloud. I interviewed the guy who wrote a O'Reilly book on Docker.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I was like, well, what was the state before? And apparently it was just really hard to use, like labor intensive, mm-hmm, to your point. So mm-hmm, it wasn't practical. Now it sounds like it's really smooth. You can just kind of plug and play on a software level. And so you just put it right in, right?
Yeah, the solution prior to Docker was actual virtual machines. And there's a thing called VirtualBox that's, and there are others, that literally let you configure a virtual machine, and you can put a virtual machine in a virtual machine.
Amazing. In a virtual machine.
Yeah.
In a parking lot.
Yeah.
In
But the problem there is now your virtualization is at such a low level that you get a big performance hit because you're not using native file systems, you're using virtual file systems, which are built on top of real file systems. And then if you virtualize a virtualized box, then you can see it. You're beginning to stack and stack everything. Every call is not one call, it's three calls as it digs through the virtual boxes. Docker allows the thing that you're installing to pretty much run against the services in the native operating system. So it's like a if I imagine this as a picture with a great big 6-inch border, you're cutting out the 6-inch border, you just have the picture sort of thing.
Cool. So it's so the bottom line is it's making your life easier.
Yeah.
And it's enabling innovation and the speed. I've heard this quote: "Big doesn't beat small, fast beats slow."
That's right.
So you've pretty much seen that, and maybe you're a living, breathing example of that in the company as well. Wow, that was a pretty awesome tangent.
All right.
I feel like we went all the way up into the cloud, and now it's like, okay, we're back here.
Yeah, you know literally.
So I feel like you already kind of touched on sort of like Bitcoin and the blockchain, but I guess you want to give us your really quick short answer. Like, how would you define Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is two things. It's a payment system and it's a token. You don't have a payment system without the token. You don't have a token without a payment system. You don't have the blockchain without incentives. Bitcoin is its own incentive, so it's all internal. When people talk about blockchains without tokens, all they're really saying is we want to externalize the incentives. That's fine, but you never have a blockchain without incentives. Mm-hmm. So if you want to pay me literal dollars, mm-hmm. to run a node in a blockchain, that works because I have the incentive to take your dollars and run this thing. If the very software I'm running issues me tokens, now I don't need you. I'm still incentivized to participate in the system. And so Bitcoin is this incredibly, incredibly insightful and innovative and amazing idea of creating software that just gives you numbers as a reward for having run the software. And now that I have these numbers, I can give those numbers to someone else or I can keep them for myself. That totally fascinated mm-hmm. upwards of 20 people for a year.
And I've found that it's not as much mining, it's more like competitive bookkeeping.
Yeah, right?
It's like this kind of, if we use the term mining, it's easy to understand, but like, so to your point, it's kind of like I think mm-hmm. that's very accurate what you said about the numbers. So it's like, oh yeah, you got my numbers.
Yeah,
so.
You got your numbers. And it was just numbers for a year. And then there was an exchange. And the second there was an exchange, there was a price. And once there was a price, then it was money. And then once there was money, the number of people that wanted in on this game exploded, and you eventually got to where you are today, where Bitcoin is literally, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, at least three orders of magnitude, the most secure ledger on the planet. There is not any other ledger tracking any other information that has as much cryptographic locks and security built on top of it as Bitcoin has. It's just massive.
One thing, and I feel like you're the right person to ask, like, why is it so secure? Like, I mean, from the standpoint of the encryption behind it, because I think a lot of people don't fully understand encryption, me included, and mm-hmm. it's like, why is it so secure?
Well,
I wondered that. Like,
well, I mean,
from a layperson's perspective, you know?
Yeah, and so let me be brutal. There is no encryption.
All right.
It's hashing. Okay. Hashing and digital signatures. Because obviously. Well, anyway. But why is it so secure? Well, for one thing, we have incentivized the construction of ever-increasingly more efficient hardware to run the software that lends the security. Okay, so that's one. So this hardware is so good that people that don't have this hardware can't possibly run the algorithms as fast as the people that do have it. So any attacker has to build hardware. They can't build hardware. Doesn't even matter if it's the US, China, and Russia and all the supercomputers they own. They don't have enough computing power to compare to the custom hardware that is being used by people that are securing Bitcoin. Okay, so that's one. And that's fascinating.
That's fascinating. The construction of mining has created this really powerful, like,
specialized security computer.
I'm glad you answered that, not me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy to think about. So because of the construction of this technology and then the use of it, mm-hmm. it's created this sort of world of this ledger that has all this data that's been constructed, as you said.
Right. And then if you can envision the Russian nesting dolls, the Matryoshka dolls, right? You put a lock on your data. That's one doll. Then you take that doll and you put it in another one and you put another lock on it. And then you put in that one in another and you put another lock on it. So when I talk about the security of the Bitcoin blockchain, I'm talking about a blockchain that puts more or less 140 locks on the past every day since 2009. Okay, so those early entries have more locks on them than anything else. I mean, no one's out there putting cryptographic locks on data at that rate. And then when you consider that each one of those locks is the result of 4 petahashes, petahashes is what happens after trillions and after billions. I mean, it's quadrillions of hashes per second. So it's the result of 10 minutes of hashing at that rate. Finally, someone finds this lock. It's like Fort Knox built inside of Fort Knox, built inside of Fort Knox, built inside of Fort Knox, and you've completely used up all of the East Coast, and then you took that and you put it someplace secure. Okay?
You shrunk it down and stuck inside of a pile of hay.
Oh, Krypton, the lost city. You know, you're in the fortress of solitude, and you know, there's no metaphors for this. It's just unbelievably secure, which is one of the reasons why I find it fascinating that the financial industry goes, well, we don't want to talk about Bitcoin, and I'm like, well, yeah, I get that you don't want to talk about the token, but you just can't put that security down. You know, why wouldn't you want that security applied to your data?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you could do it for a tenth of a cent for a K of data. That's okay. That's factum. That's what we do. We take the security of Bitcoin and we apply it to arbitrarily large sets of data. There just isn't too much data to put into factum at this point.
And could you touch on how Merkle trees are involved in that? I don't really know much about them,
okay.
But Merkle, I know you mentioned it in your talk.
Yeah. Merkle trees are they're South Asian fruit, and it's kind of a yellow.
Meat is delicious.
The Merkles. The
nice.
Merkles.
Yeah,
Merkle fruit.
Yeah, your Merkle pie. I'm going to bring a Merkle pie to the next.
Can't wait.
Plucked from the very best Merkle trees
that I grow
in my backyard.
Okay. It wasn't on the top of Mount Everest picked by a monk.
Okay, so Merkle trees. The way I describe Merkle trees is this. Let's say I have a lot of data. Imagine an elementary school that has 500 students, and every one of these students produces a report, and we would like to create some sort of security that covers all 500 reports, okay? Now, obviously, because this is 2016, those reports are digital. They did them on iPads. So getting a hash of those reports is no big deal. Now, what's a hash? Now, you got to understand hashing. Hashing is this really, really, really curious thing that it's an algorithm that we've been testing for years and years that takes any digital artifact, a document, a picture, a song, a movie, anything that's on your computer, and it runs through the numbers that make that up, and it reduces it to a number that is 32 bytes, 256 bits long. Okay, now that doesn't mean anything to most of our listeners, but think of it as a number that's about 2.5 inches long. Okay, it's just 2.5 inches of numbers. Okay? Now, the math behind it makes that almost always unique. In other words, in as many years as we've been using the algorithm that creates this hash, we've never seen two things that produce the same number. And the odds of us actually finding another number, two digital documents that will produce the same hash, the odds are estimated to be something like if you won the lottery. And again, and again, 800 trillion times.
In a row.
Yes.
Oh my God. That's unimaginably huge.
So it just isn't going to happen.
Let it ride.
Okay.
Let it ride.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're saying there's a chance.
There is a chance.
Oh my God.
And a lot of people leap on the fact that there is a chance.
Oh God.
But it is so vanishingly small. So, okay. So if you've got your head around the hash that I can take anything and I can produce a unique number, okay? Now, suppose I have two of those things and I combine them together. When I hash that, I will get a unique number. And so I go through the entire school and I pair everybody up. I hash their documents and combine them. I now have 250 hashes. And then I do that again with those results and I half that number. I do it again and I half that number. And I do it again and I half that number. So they're all combined, and when I get down to the very end, I'll have one number. That one number is unique to literally those 500 reports in the order that they were that I processed. You know, so I have not only the uniqueness of each report, but I'm even maintaining their order. Okay, so I have that one number, and that provides me cryptographic proof of all that. That number I can stick someplace like in the Bitcoin blockchain, and now Bitcoin blockchain does that same kind of hashing game on it, and now that number is as secure as anything in Bitcoin. So now, let's suppose Susie Q, who did one of these reports, I want to have a proof that she was one of the reports in that elementary school. Now, what most people would think, well, now that means I have to have all 500 documents and I'd have to have them all in the right order so that I can do all this same computation to get the same hash. No, not true. What I need is the hash of her paper and the neighbor that she combined it with. If I have those two hashes, I can produce the hash of the one level down. Then I need to know what hash I combined that one with, and so forth. I only need a handful of hashes, and so now
that represents a lot of data and records.
It represents a lot of data and records. I have a proof of a truth that's small of a membership in a data set that is huge, and it works for 500 days. It works for a billion data elements. And so I can have very, very small proofs that particular data exists in very, very large data sets. And without boring the listener, this can be combined in interesting ways so that you can do very, very interesting things, like prove a particular data set exists in a huge sea of data. that's important because if I want to know something about water meter measurements that were done in Shreveport, Louisiana, and there was some sort of system that was using Factum and the Bitcoin blockchain to secure all the water measurements in the entire United States.
So that they couldn't be affected or manipulated,
right.
Like, and that's a big
part
of it, right?
And to prove that no one is juicing the numbers to produce a particular result that might result in a particular contract. See, the thing is, mm-hmm. when you mess with data, you often are messing with money. So,
the end result.
The end result. But the funny thing about data is you very rarely know how you want to mess with it in the moment. It's later when you realize, oh, if this data was this way, then I would be paid 10% more. So why don't we just change the data a little bit? So the idea is, as you collect the data, you immediately lock it down. Because after it's locked down, nobody gets to change it. And the faster and closer to real time you lock data down, the less chance anyone can come back later and manipulate and lie.
This is something like, for my current day job, I'm in biotech and farm industry and keep electronic notebooks.
Yes.
Right? And you have to digitally sign them.
Yes.
And it's a cumbersome, slow, and brutal process that every time I use it, I go, this should be on a blockchain. Because
yes.
we're forced to, because they need to keep it for auditing purposes for when an invention was created.
Right.
They can go back and prove, on this day, at this time, this person put in this notebook, this day, whenever it was, that they created this thought or this concept.
And this could apply to laws because they're so tricky with the way they change laws, because it'll be like section 4.5.7.8, and then they might actually move it into a whole other section, because I've seen like someone breaking down a certain law and they like went through like this year it was this and this, and they'll change the number assigned to it. But with what you just explained, we could actually have better tracking of like that rhetoric and like how it, okay, so it was in this, it was sort of in like this section, and then, oh, and I noticed in 2005 they moved it here, because, you know, mm-hmm. I know that happens from that documentary, and this would help organize it.
Yes.
You can keep track of data even if it moves around.
Yeah, you can detect the moves. You can detect the moves. I mean, mm-hmm. moving the data changes the hash patterns. And so the digital proof not only proves the content, but proves the order. And so where you care about the order, you can look at that. Where you don't care about the order, well, you know, fine. The idea is you have a 100% total pristine view of what the data should be in order to match that hash, and nobody gets to monkey with it. The thing about humans is we're constantly finding the way to manipulate the past in order to produce a future we would prefer. Okay? And so one of the things that Factum is allowing us to do is it's allowing even the powerless to go on record in a way that cannot be rewritten by the powerful.
Historically have controlled that information across the board.
Yeah, the George Orwell quote, "He who controls the present controls the past, and whoever controls the past controls the future."
Wow.
You take away control of the past and you make a more honest and fair and more livable world. I think we get rid of so many abuses. And it's impossible as we sit here to know exactly how amazingly game-changing this is, because we've never been able to stop the manipulation of the past before. So if we do stop it, we'll see what happens.
It's a very simple concept that takes a lot of technical expertise to execute.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't available even 5 years ago. I'm sure that there was, or 7 years ago, right? I mean, there was people who obviously wanted this kind of security of being able to lock down the past, but I'm really glad that you guys have dedicated so much energy and time, because it's not like Factum just started.
No. We've been working about a year and a half at this point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I'm really glad that you guys have made such a great effort, and your team is, and everybody that we've talked to is fantastic. So.
Okay.
We wish you the best of luck going forward. And is there a way that people can reach out to you?
You can certainly go to factum.org, and there is a way to register for notices and announcements of things that are happening in the Factum world. You find out when blog posts go up and that sort of stuff. So you can track the project. You can reach me at paul@factum.org. And otherwise, I'm on the internet. I'm not really that hard to find. So.
Right. Like you said, everyone's very accessible. You just have to reach out, right?
Yeah, you just have to reach out. And it is impressive. You would be amazed at who will talk to you, and you'll be amazed at what you can learn if you would just take the opportunities.
And the more people that can be engaged in an intelligent way, you know, like,
yes,
we'll keep coming up with better and better questions, and we'll have to definitely get you back on here, because you're just tons of wisdom and experience. So, no, I'm serious.
And you're fun to talk to.
Yeah, and you're fun to talk to. So it's it's great. Thank you for your time and joining us. We'll definitely have to do this again.
All right. Thank you very much.
Talk to you again. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for making this.